Session number 11105, Colonel M. McBain, Reel 24.
Colonel M. McBain, Reel 24. The environment in which you were living and working in, Colonel, and of course the length of time that we were there, was morale at any time a question and boredom a problem?
Again, at this distance in time, I'm not conscious of there being a morale problem. There was boredom, certainly, but people found things to do. There was a lot of, we were very well supported with books and magazines and papers. I don't think there wasn't a radio station as such, but by this time, of course, soldiers had transistor radios and things like that with them in the base. And certainly I can't remember having to make a conscious effort to do something, you know, wake up one morning and say, I must do something about morale, or we must do this and must do that. We just led our life, and we were all pretty busy. I mean, after a patrol had been over for 5 or 10 days, when it got back, it was quite happy just to sit around and read and write letters and chat and eat good food and so on, because they were going back in again fairly soon. And so when they were actually in the base, they weren't in the base very long, and when they were in the base, there was plenty to do. And of course there was a rest and recuperation scheme, an R&R scheme, where they'd go off to Kuching 4 or 5 days during the time we were there. So that was always to look forward to. We knew, of course, that we were there for a finite length of time. I think it was 1 year. Whereas I think possibly in other campaigns it's been a bit indefinite. We knew that we were there for a year unless something very odd happened. And so I'm not aware of and certainly there was no discipline problem. With minor bits and pieces like dirty rifles or something like that, but no major dramas. I may have been very lucky, but I don't think there was anything in other companies. I'm not aware of anything going on. There was no occasion for me, for example, to have to ask the commanding officer to come and deal with a case at all. So they must have all been such as they were within my capabilities as company commander to deal with.
So had you much paperwork, I think, in terms of reports and so forth that were thrown?
Well, yes,
to and
I there was the normal routine paperwork, because the army loved wherever, as you say, reports about this and reports about that and so on. Indenting for this and reporting on that. So, yeah, the paperwork carried on. There was no let up in that. So that was a fairly normal activity. The command post that I had was comparatively luxurious. It was quite a big one, which I shared with the gunner. And sitting in there working on the paperwork and so on was no great pain. Very comfortable.
Did you receive any visitors from high-ranking people? I mean, even above the battalion commander?
Yes. We used to get, the brigadier, who was a wonderful man. I'm going to ask me his name. Sadly, he's dead. I know that. He died very sadly of cancer. Gordon Highlander, and he was a wonderful man. Cab? I'm sorry, I just cannot remember, but he was a great man, and he left us very much to get on, or left the commanding officer very much to get on with it. But he used to come round and visit, and it was always nice to see him. On one of these great helicopter operations that were in full flood, he appeared in his little helicopter. And he clearly realised it was a mistake, because the air was full of helicopters. Anyway, Corporal Luke told him to push off and come back later, which he did, bless him. In fact, one of his staff officers, his DAQMG, was Robert McGregor Oakford from the Downright Infantry. So we had that contact as well. And various people used to heave in and out again, but a great joy of being on the end of a helicopter. Because you knew they were coming, and if the helicopter was doing something else, they couldn't come. That also supplied, I think, generally to the British forces in comparison to the Americans in Vietnam. We had very few press or media visitors. I had one the whole year I was there, and you knew by the time anyone like that got to you, they'd been through so many filters that they were all right, and you could really say what you wanted to them, because they would be sensible about what they filed for report. In fact, this was a girl from the London Illustrated News, and she was great, but that was the big difference, whereas the Americans were having a terrible time with their media. Every move they made, there was someone there with a camera taking a picture of it. We never saw anyone, really, which, of course, they tried to use the same tactics, I think. I wasn't involved, but I think they tried to use the same tactics in the Falklands. Well, things have been since the Borneo. And there was a lot of tough feeling between the media and the services, particularly the Royal Navy, in the Falklands. But she was the only one I saw, and that was that. So morale and discipline and so on, I'm not aware of any great problems. Whether this was, one would like to think perhaps, it was because we were all professionals, and we were all there of our own choice. Nobody had called us up and sent us there. That would be a factor, certainly. And that we were all doing a job that we'd been trained to do. And visitors were all always very grateful for being allowed to come to see us, which was great. And they normally brought a bottle of whiskey with them, so that was all right.
Did you ever encounter any activity, any action?
No. My little neck of the woods turned out to be fairly peaceful. Our predecessors, the Green Jackets, they'd had one very minor do, but it was a fairly quiet part of the country. The only bit of the battalion that had some activity was A Company next door, John Arnott's company. And they did have a contact during one of their company operations. But Robin Crawford with C Company, B Company, no. The battalion second in command, he nearly drowned the recce platoon in a river, but apart from that, was another Malayan jungle man. He'd been there with the Gurkhas, so he knew all about the jungle, and so he took the recce platoon off in longboats, which were long native boats with great big outboard motors on the back. They used to go like steam on a river. What somebody had forgotten to tell him, or he'd been told and forgotten, was that this particular river had a tidal bore like the River Severn. So they were steaming down this river, and the tidal bore came up, and away they went. Fortunately, nobody was drowned. They lost a lot of kit there. No, there wasn't a lot of activity. because, as I say, the thing was grinding to a standstill, really, and Easings, I think, had realised that they weren't going to achieve anything, so they were quietly going home.
Who was battalion commander?
It was Gil Morn, who'd taken over just before we left Hong Kong. And he was a great guy. I mean, we all knew him very well. Certainly I knew him very well. We all got on well together. In fact, it really was a very happy battalion. In a bunch of people like that, I suppose quite often you can say, well, I didn't much of him. I didn't like him very much. But I can't honestly say that about anyone. We all got on very well together. And then came the time to leave, and as I said, we were not going to hand over this base to anyone. So we started pulling it apart, dismantling it, and where we couldn't actually dismantle it, we blew it. The thing that fascinated me was, I think I may have described right at the very beginning, my own personal sleeping bunker. It was a very comfortable place, it was panelled with plywood and so on. And up in the roof, however, something lived. And we never knew what it was. I mean, this was a plywood roof ceiling. And I'd get into bed, and this thing would start walking about up there. And we tried. They used to have a thing called rat cakes. They were round, sort of biscuit type thing was made of rat poison that we would leave scant, because obviously in a place like that you had rats and various other things. So we put some of these rat cakes up, and this blooming thing used a football, and it would bang them, and it would slide right across the, and the noise inside this plywood box was deafening. However, you've got, like living beside a railway line, I suppose you get used to anything, and after a few weeks it was up there, but I didn't worry. But of course, when we came to dismantle, we were all agog, because the whole company knew that the company commander had something living with him. When the roof started coming off my bunker, see what the hell it was. And you know, there wasn't a sign of anything. There were no droppings, there was no. So what the hell it had been, I don't know. It was big enough to sound like a cat. Anyway, there was nothing there when the roof came off, so that was that. And then, very touching, just literally the day, and I was the last person out, the locals turned up with two sandbags. One was full of pepper, corns, you know, the black things. And the other had the biggest pineapple I've ever seen, I think. Very green. Well, that's going to be just right by the time we get home, because we were going flying out to Battalion quarters, down the road to Kuching, onto a ship, and then 2 days, I think, across to Singapore, onto an aeroplane and home. Well, it didn't quite work out like that, but that was the theory. But I mean, this sandbag full of pepper, I mean, goodness knows what that was worth. But of course, pepper is one of the natural crops. For years after that, I eventually put it in a suitcase in Singapore. And for years after that, using that suitcase, there'd be pepper things flying around wherever it was. I mean, it was a long, long time. I think the suitcase gave out before we got rid of them all. Anyway, that was nice. And so off we went. And
what date was this?
Oh, boy. I think it must have been midsummer. 1966, I suppose. I'm hopeless with dates. I think it must have been I'm saying midsummer because when we got home, we all went on leave. And the McBain family took itself off into the middle of Scotland. Well, we wouldn't have done that other than summertime. So whether it was early summer, I would suggest probably early summer. 66. We got down to the ship in Kuching, and this was a proper Somerset Maugham ship, or not Somerset Maugham, who's the other guy? Conrad. Joseph Conrad. It was a proper Malaysian ship. And the three rifle companies were on board this ship again. And for some reason, best known to whoever runs them, we sat in Kuching Harbour for 3 days, where I don't think anyone minded too much, certainly because this was the first time the boys had drunk. Despite what they'd said in Hong Kong, they said they were going to drink themselves all the way through. You won't, you know. I'm not going to stop you, but I bet you very soon after you get there, you'll be on soft drinks. Blah, 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 they said. But of course, they were, because alcohol and that sort of conditions don't mix. And so on the ship was the first time, really, they were at liberty to drink, and they did. But of course, because they were on a ship, they couldn't get themselves into trouble. They just drank themselves into a stupor, really. We had a farewell cocktail party on board for the officers, and that was really Somerset Maughamish on the deck of the stern and so on. And eventually we pushed off. We drank the ship dry twice. It had been stocked in Singapore for the worst possible case they could think of, and that was moving an Australian battalion from Singapore to Kuching. Well, they hadn't catered for the Geordies after a year's abstinence, and so we did. We drank it dry twice. And off we went to Singapore, got there, and then, of course, it was a question of an aeroplane at a time flying home. And sadly, C Company drew the short straw, and we were the last out. So we sat in a transit camp in Singapore for about 10 days, I suppose, which was a long time then, because you wanted to get on and away. But we were comfortable enough. But the tale of my pineapple, of course, that was different. We picked up our little treasures in Kuching, where they'd been since we'd arrived, suitcases and bits and pieces that we hadn't had in the jungle. And so we got all that out and started dressing ourselves properly again. And I put this pineapple in my kit bag for onward transmission. And of course, I was stupid, of course, you're not thinking about it. What a kit bag with a pineapple in it looks like when it's been buried under 600 other kit bags in a ship for 4 days. And it got out at Singapore, and phew, it arrived in my room in the mess. And I couldn't think what this smell was. And it was this mashed pineapple fermenting gently in the tropical heat. It stank. So that was the end of the pineapple, and that was away. Yes, we must have been in Singapore for a week or 10 days, because I had time to go up into Malaya to see some friends up there. Mine just for one night, I think. So we must have been there for 10 days. Anyway, eventually we got on an aeroplane, which was a four-engine petrol-driven job of some sort, Hastings or something. A charter aircraft. Just my company, basically. All travelling in plain clothes, of course. We were civilian. We had to be civilians because we were flying over various places that didn't like the British very much. And of course, each soldier had his own passport. So eventually we came down. One of the stops was Bahrain, I think. And although I had been very careful to make one of my young officers the officer in charge of this aeroplane, the driver came back to me and said, if it's as hot as they say it is in Bahrain when we land to refuel, we will have to sit on the ground and wait till it gets cooler, because when we're full of petrol, we can't take off in extreme heat. So we got there, and they opened the doors, and boy, yeah, it was as hot as they said it was. It was very hot. We got off the aircraft and went into the airport building, which was air-conditioned, and we were asked to stay inside the building, not to wait. And so we sat there, and I mean, we'd no idea how long we were going to be there. But eventually we recognised there were some military noises coming from behind this building, and so my sergeant major and I walked out casually and round the back of the building, and sure enough, there was a Kuwaiti guard of honour practising. Then they caught us and asked us to go back in the building again, so we went back in the building. Sure enough, very soon after that, literally, a red carpet was rolled out from the terminal building, and an Egyptian comet turned up, and out came a very important-looking Egyptian army officer, and the guard was there for him. And, of course, what was interesting was, if it hadn't been for the slightly sunburnt faces, it was a British ceremony. They were wearing British uniforms, British words of command, British weapons, the whole thing was British. And of course, what that Egyptian general would have said if he'd known that 120 British soldiers were actually watching, it's interesting, but that's the funny world we live in at the moment. Eventually, it was got back on this old aeroplane and we lumbered off the ground. The next stop was Istanbul, and again the driver came back and said, although we were on the ground in Kuwait, it was still counting against my flying time. And so if we don't get a quick turnaround at Istanbul, then we're going to have to stop somewhere for the night. Oh, God. Or, you know, for a rest. And so when we got over Istanbul, which apparently only had one petrol pump, why the aircraft didn't slip out of the sky, I don't know, because everyone was looking down to see if there was anything else on the ground. It was in the middle of the night. Fortunately, there was nothing there, so we landed and went straight to the petrol pump and filled up and away. And I thought, well, that's fine. And he came back and said, well, no, we've got a headwind. Where would you like to stop, Rimini or Marseille, I think he said. We don't really want to stop anywhere. We'd rather go to London. Well, we might have to. Depends. Anyway, we eventually got home. Forget what time of day it was we landed. It was daylight anyway. Doesn't matter. We did get home. And we were met and straight down to Colchester, where we were going to be stationed. And great family reunions and so on, and then on leave. I was due to go back onto the staff at this stage, and very shortly after we came back to work after leave, I was told where I was going, and I was going to what to me sounded a pretty strange job in headquarters, Allied Forces Central Europe, who at that time were in Fontainebleau. Everyone said, oh, you are lucky. I don't know, I wasn't too sure. Anyway, the problem was, as far as I was concerned, that it was just about that stage when de Gaulle decided that he didn't want NATO in France. And so all the NATO establishments in France were under notice. And Allied Forces Central Europe, absent, was scheduled to move within 4 or 5 months. And so that meant I was not entitled to take my family with me. So that was a pain in the neck. However, off I went to Fontainebleau. And I didn't really enjoy that. It wasn't a happy headquarters. And it was a very strange environment because by that time all the Allied headquarters in France had distilled themselves down to everyone in the headquarters, all the various national elements, all had French grannies or French ancestry or French wives, and they thought France was marvellous. I personally didn't think very much of France. However, they thought it was great. And so they just didn't believe, couldn't believe that de Gaulle meant what he said. And so nobody did anything about moving at all. And this was an organisation, I suppose, not far short of the size of the British Ministry of Defence, having to move. But nobody did very much anyway. Sorry, that I, in fact, did move with the headquarters from France into Holland, into a disused coal mine. The Dutch must still be laughing all the way to the bank, I should think. How they managed to sell a disused coal mine to NATO, I don't know. However, that's where we did, coal mine in Brunsum. And to my relief, I was then... I'd made it clear I wasn't at all happy with what I was doing and where I was and all the rest of it. And if anything else came up, I'd be very happy to move. And in
fact, this is basically administrative type of work.
Yes, it was a staff officer's job in the exercise division of AFSCENT. But I just didn't like the environment, and so it wasn't a happy environment.
What rank were you?
I was major. And as luck would have it, a job suddenly became vacant in another NATO headquarters in Schleswig-Holstein. And I was asked if I'd go there, and I said, yeah, fine, anywhere to get away from Brunsum. And so off we went, and we then had two quite happy years in Rendsburg on the Kiel Canal. I was the only British officer in what was basically a Danish-German headquarters with the statutory Americans. And we had a very happy time there. We enjoyed that.
What were you doing there?
Well, not a lot. Because, in fact, NATO by this time really wasn't doing very much. That may sound odd, but the reason being, of course, they'd been planning since 1945, basically. And you can only plan so much and revise the revision and so on. In this headquarters, which had the resounding title of Headquarters Commander Land Forces Jutland, Comland Jut, and the British officer there was really the successor to... the job in 1945, I don't really know where it came from, but a Scandinavian brigade, Norwegian and Danish brigade, appeared in Schleswig-Holstein and was stationed there. Whether that had come from UK or whether it had come from Norway and Denmark, I just don't know. But it was there, you know, right at the end of when the war, they came in, and a British liaison team was attached, a British officer and a couple of NCOs, and basically I was the direct successor of that. And when I arrived, my predecessor, who was not a great military man, I don't think, but he said really the main point of the job was to ensure that the Danish contingent got duty-free drink and petrol. And as long as you had time to play bridge two or three times a week, it didn't really matter very much. Well, that didn't suit me too well. So I was in what was called the G2 division, that's the intelligence branch of the headquarters. And so I got stuck in and got involved with the headquarters, which my predecessor hadn't, to such an extent that, in fact, by the time I left, it has nothing to do with me. The decisions are being made in all sorts of places, but it had been decided that there's a British brigade would be earmarked to reinforce this division by landing in Jutland in the case of war. And so because of that, they needed another British officer in Rendsburg, and used to beach landings and all the rest of it. And so it was an obvious job for a Marine. And so to this day, there are now two British officers there, a Marine and another.